Thanks, John. Good morning, everybody, and welcome again to our meeting on this Lord's Day morning. Hope it'll be the beginning of a week that will be fulfilling and rewarding for you and your loved ones. And I'd like to ask you to keep my loved ones in your prayers, and we appreciate that very much. I wonder if you think it would be possible for someone to come saying the things Jesus said and doing the work Jesus does and expressing the purposes that Jesus has and being moved with the motives that Jesus displayed and doing the signs that Jesus does, and then it not make any difference how we respond to it? I don't think so. Do you? Do you think that there could be someone like that, and then for indifference to him or rejection of him to be just as good as not? I really think that that's one of the things that we are meant to pay attention to as we come in the ministry of Jesus to the last week of the work the Father gave him to do. There is, throughout this week, a lot of attention paid to the things that Jesus is saying and doing, and then to the things that his critics and enemies are saying and doing because of the tension that is being caused. It's really interesting, if you think about it, how much of the material we have in the Gospels is really focused on these things. About a third of the Gospel of Luke, about a fourth of the Gospel of Luke, and then about a third of the Gospels of Matthew and Mark are occupied with just this one week. About half, almost half, of the Gospel of John is focused on just what is said and done during this period of time. And what you notice when you read it is, as I've described it here, a rising level of tension where you get the feeling that something is going to happen, something has got to give here. The drama is coming to its key moments now. And when you look at the material we have in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John about these days of the Lord's ministry, I think you get the idea that divine judgment, the reality of divine judgment, the necessity of divine judgment is the theme that ties all of this together. And you get the impression that without this material, we're not going to be able to recognize what Jesus has laid on him on the cross, or what he bears for us on the cross. Without thinking about the impact of these events, we're not going to be able to respect the debt we owe to the Lord. And we won't be able to rejoice and the amazing grace of God unless we realize the way the Lord conducts himself in the face of this kind of stuff. And so it's not only the idea that judgment is necessary, but that judgment from this kind of the Lord will have a certain tone to it. What I've done is to choose five snippets from the Gospel of Luke. This is not all that happens during this period of time, but it's representative of all that happens. And I've chosen it because this event starts with and concludes with a citation from that portion of Psalm 118 that Scott read for us in the beginning of our meeting today. And so I'll let that be the framework for it. This is the Lord coming into the gates of righteousness, and then this is our response to the one who is blessed because he comes in the name of the Lord. And our responsibility can be observed in the middle of all of this. We start in Luke 19, in verses 28 through 40, with Jesus blessing, his being blessed by the people. This happens on the first day of the last week of the Lord's life. And if you remember, it is a Passover time in Jerusalem, which means that pilgrims from all over have arrived in Jerusalem, and the hustle and bustle of this period of time would have been remarkable in its own way. And then the fact that the redeeming work of God is always the focus at Passover time, what God gave to bring his people up out of their slavery is what was being remembered, and the sacrifice that was offered and eaten is the central part of all of this. And then the things that Jesus has been doing and the word that's been spreading about the things Jesus has been doing is a part of the mix of everything that's going on. There are a bunch of people who've come up to Jerusalem from Galilee who know about the miracles and signs that Jesus has been doing, who've been wanting for him to show himself as the Messiah, to come out in the open as the Christ. And then there are the people in Jerusalem who are the religious authorities who are responsible for the conducting of the affairs of the temple and all of the things that will happen in that city during the days following this. And what happens is that Jesus has been telling his disciples ever since Luke 9 and verse 51 that we're going up to Jerusalem. He's been telling them what will happen at Jerusalem. That's been the goal. That's been the hour. That's been the purpose. That's been where all of his work is aiming. And so while they're staying out at Bethany, which is 2 miles out east of Jerusalem over the Mount of Olives, he sends his disciples to one of the villages, and as if he either knows ahead of time what will happen or maybe even has arranged this on purpose, he tells them where they're going to find a colt tied up, and it's a colt that has never been ridden by anybody and is therefore pure and serviceable for holy purposes, and they're to untie that colt, and if anyone asks them about it, they're to tell the owners, the Lord has need of him. And it happens just as he has told them, and they bring the colt to him, and they set him on it, according to Luke 19, in verse 34, verse 35, they throw their cloaks on it and they set Jesus on it. Now, the two things that we need to know about this. One is from 1 Kings 9, when Solomon is made king and he's set on an animal like this with the cloaks of people, and he's presented as the king. Welcomed as the king. And the second thing is that in the Old Testament, in Zechariah 9 and verse 9, the king, the prince of peace, or the king of peace, was going to come to Jerusalem riding on the colt of a donkey. So all of these people who have been wanting the Messiah to be shown and to be made known and to be presented are now given, about to be given the opportunity, and there are There are all of these pilgrims from Galilee who are present, and they line the way as Jesus makes his way on this colt toward the city. And there are people in the city who have heard about the raising of Lazarus, and they've come out toward Bethany to see what's going on and what's about to happen. And in all of this scene, the crowds meet, and here comes Jesus, and with them throwing their cloaks down on the path in front of him as if to pay homage to him and to welcome him. And here's what the scripture says, verse 37. As he was drawing near, already on the way down the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of his disciples began to rejoice and to praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." That's from Psalm 118, verse 26, you might remember. Mark suggests that the kingdom, the coming of the kingdom, is being recognized and celebrated here with the arrival of this King. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. Peace was announced at the birth of Jesus by angels, and peace is announced by the crowds at Jerusalem as his ministry comes to its head. Glory to the and the highest. The other accounts use the word Hosanna as God is praised in this way. The people are celebrating and rejoicing and recognizing Jesus as the one that they've been looking forward to for so long. And then it says some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples. Calm them down. Tell them to be quiet. Don't let them recognize you that way." They are not wanting a king like this to be made known. They don't see Jesus as the king who had been coming. They don't want trouble to be caused. In verse 40, he answers, "I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out." He's the Messiah, and he'll be recognized. He has to be. This has to be known. And if people don't do it, nature itself will get a tongue and start praising him and welcoming him in this way. The arrival of Jesus as the King of Peace takes place in a manner as if planned by him so that it can't be ignored and it won't allow indifference. There is the tension that I'm getting at. You've got him accepting praise, a crowd shouting it, and people trying to shut him up. That can't go on without something being settled. In the second place, the second snippet, here is Jesus weeping. Comes down to over the Mount of Olives, and to everybody's embarrassment and puzzlement, he begins to break down and just the kind of sobbing that would heave from your abdomen. That's the strength of the word that's used here. Look at it. When he drew near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, "Would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace." Now think about what's being said there. There, the crowd has proclaimed peace in heaven. You might remember the name Jerusalem means city of peace. Jesus looks down knowing what's going to happen in a few days to him and what's going to happen in a few years to them. Just just breaks down in grief. But now they are hidden from your eyes. In John chapter 12 and verses 27 and following, the point is made by the Lord that when people have been given evidence and shown light as if by these signs of His, and they have rejected them and ignored them, they get to the place where they not only do not believe, but where they cannot believe. And that's the situation for the authorities in Jerusalem now. He says, "For the days will come upon you when your enemies will set a barricade around you." In other words, they'll dig a trench and they'll throw up siege works and dirt against your walls so that they can climb over and tear them down. And they'll surround you and hem you in on every side the way the Romans did to Jerusalem in AD 70 and just before, and tear you down to the ground, and you and your children within you, and they will not leave one stone upon another in you. Jesus saw the consequences of the rejection of what God had been offering them because you did not know the time of your visitation. Visitation meant that God had come to help them, to save them, and to rescue them. It would have been like Israel being in Egypt and God doing all of these things to bring them out and the people saying, "No, we won't go." That's what's happened with Jerusalem. And the Lord knows that when lost people reject saving, sooner or later, they are lost. And it grieves him. He agonizes over it. I found a comment from someone about this that I thought was thought-provoking. Someone wrote, "It is surely remarkable that at the very moment when Jesus warned the city of judgment, he was weeping over them in love." Divine judgment is a solemn, awesome reality. But the God who judges is the God who weeps. He is not willing that any should perish. And when in the end his judgment falls on anybody, as Jesus said it will, God's eyes will be full of tears. That's what this episode might illustrate for us. It's followed now by Jesus' cleansing. Mark tells us that on this first day of that last week, Jesus entered the temple and looked around. Luke tells us a little more about what happened, and then there are some details from the other records that help to fill out the picture. He entered the temple. The temple was overseen by the priest, the high priest family in the time when Jesus lived. And the temple would be the center of attention during the Passover time. The high priest had a situation where all the people who traveled to Jerusalem and brought money from all the different places they'd come from would have to change that money into a particular coin that would be acceptable there, a coin without images on it and so forth. So there'd have to be money exchanging. And to make it convenient, of course, he set it up for a fee. And then people would have to have a Passover to sacrifice, and it would have to be a male, a year old, without blemish. And one might be bought somewhere else, but it would have to be inspected at the temple and be accepted. So you might as well just to buy one at the temple. So he set it up for about five times the price it might cost somewhere else. After all, his excuse is without blemish. And Jesus walks into the temple. John tells us about him making a whip out of cords, and the others tell us about his overthrowing the tables of the money changers and so forth, probably in the court of the Gentiles. And it says, he said, he began to drive out those who sold, saying to them, "It is written, my house shall be a house of prayer, but you've made it a den of robbers." You can hear the Lord's anger and the abuse of what was meant to be a place to meet God. And if you wonder why in John 19, when Jesus is arrested, he's taken first to the household of Annas, the man who was really the head of the high priestly family, and why there seems to be the kind of humiliating and mistreating of Jesus that happened there. I think this is the reason. There's the getting even for this driving out. For Jesus to refer to this as my house, and then to make it the place where he daily taught, verse 47 says, with the chief priests and the scribes and the principal men of the city looking on like ravenous wolves, looking for a way to destroy him. The courage of the Lord. They couldn't find anything they could do because the people were hanging on his words. Here's the action of Jesus in restoring the temple as a place of prayer and a place for his teaching to be at home. You can imagine now, can't you, the sense of his holding them accountable, judgment, and the rising tension as this goes on. Again, someone has made the observation that it's only after we've seen the tears in Jesus' eyes that we're ready to see the whip in his hands, the symbol of judgment. And that's what you see here. This is no weak man who helplessly is taken and made a martyr. The strength and the courage of the Lord is amazing. And then there's his questioning. There's several other examples of this. We'll just use this one in Luke. In Luke 20, in the first 8 verses, where the authority of Jesus is brought into question, but what turns out to be examined is the integrity of the people who want to know about the Lord's authority. He's in the temple bringing God's good news to the people, Luke 20 and verse 1, when the chief priests and scribes and elders came up. These are the three categories of men who made up the ruling council of the Jews, which was called the Sanhedrin. It consisted of 71 men who were chaired by whoever was high priest at the time. And so these are representatives, at least, from the Sanhedrin. And they say, "Tell us by what authority you do these things, or who it is that gave you this authority." Jews at the time were accustomed, you either had to have authority from the priests or authority from the rabbis, one or the other. These things may mean the cleansing of the temple or the doing of the signs or the teaching that he was doing, or all of them together, or the entry into the city, or all. There are a lot of reasons that what they had asked about this. They wanted to see his credentials when they had been shown everywhere for 3 years, at least. He answered them, verse 3. "I'll also ask you a question. Now you tell me, was the baptism of John from heaven or from men?" Now if they really wanted to be qualified to examine someone's authority, they could have shown their ability in a test case. And if they wanted to know who he was, they might have listened to what John had to say about him. You remember, John identified him twice at least. The Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. The one who's come after me that I've told you about. And if they answered that question correctly, they would have their answer about where Jesus got his authority. But you'll notice, he shows them to be a crowd who, instead of looking for truth, instead of questioning what happens, are instead looking for expediency. They are open to making a deal in which reality is being bargained away. What they say is interesting. They start talking to each other about it. You can almost see this happening before the Lord. Huddle up like a football play. Discuss it with one another. If we say from heaven, he'll say, why do you not believe? Why did you not believe him? But if we say from man, all the people will stone us to death, for they're convinced that John was a prophet. You can tell they wanted to say from man. They didn't want to be responsible to what John had said. But they're afraid. It cost them too much to face the truth. So they answered and that they did not know where it came from. And in that kind of dishonesty, that kind of disingenuous action, they forfeited their right to know anything that Jesus might tell them. Jesus said, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. The Lord wasn't afraid to claim authority. He did it in other situations. He said more than once that he said the words his Father gave him to say. But to these guys, their lack of integrity had just been proven, and it didn't deserve any further comment from him. The truth would not have mattered to them, and Jesus knew it. What's going to happen in this situation? And then one next step in this is the Lord's warning. What someone called love's last appeal, in which the application of Jesus' identity is made to the mistreatment of heaven's grace through the rejection of his ministry. Jesus tells them a story. Beginning at verse 9, a man plants a vineyard and lets it out to tenants or to sharecroppers who went, the owner went into another country for a long time. This was common in their world. When the time came, he sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give him some of the fruit. Now this was the deal. You rented out your property to be managed by someone else on shares. He's now expecting his payment for their occupancy of his vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. They have rejected any responsibility to the owner. The owner might have been respected to come right then and hold them accountable, but he goes way beyond what would have been expected. You notice that the story continues by saying in verse 11, and he sent another servant. But they also beat and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. They treated this servant worse than the first one. What might an owner reasonably have done at that point? They deserved judgment right then. But verse 12, he sent yet a third. This one they also wounded and cast out. The mistreatment gets worse. This is unheard of, that an owner would go this far to try to appeal to the hearts of those obligated to him. The owner of the vineyard said, verse 13, "What shall I do? I'll send my beloved son. Perhaps they'll respect him." One writer calls this parable the autobiography of Jesus. If the husbandmen or the tenants represented all the prophets that God had sent down through the years and how they'd been treated, it made the sending of his beloved son even more poignant. Look how far the owner has been willing to go to try to appeal to the hearts of those responsible to him. Verse 14, "But when the tenants saw him, they said to themselves, 'This is the heir. Let's kill him so that the inheritance may be ours.'" In their day, if you had occupied a place for a certain length of time and there was no rightful heir to it, then the ownership of it passed to you. That's what they think. So, verse 15, they threw him out of the vineyard, you see, so that his blood won't be on their ground, and they killed him. And then Jesus said, "What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them?" What would your judgment have been? What did they deserve? What's the answer to this situation? In verse 18, "He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others." And when they heard this, they said, "Surely not. God forbid." Either meaning, surely nobody would treat an owner like that. Or maybe they saw that the application was it would be given to another people besides them. In verse 17, everybody pay attention to this. "But he looked directly at them." Folks, this is the moment of judgment in some people's lives. "He looked directly at them and said, 'What then is this that is written? The stone that the builders rejected has become the head of the corner.'" The cornerstone. The cornerstone gave shape to the rest of the building, or it put it to, held the whole thing together. It was the most important one. He's changed from the image of a son of the owner now to a stone in the building to illustrate that you may kill a son, but you cannot bust up the stone. God would make it the head of the corner. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and when it falls on anyone, it will crush him. And they saw that he had told that parable against them, the next verse says. What Jesus is saying is, I want to tell you all ahead of time, my being here is an expression of God's amazing grace. And you may reject even it by destroying me. But when this is done, that will be your own destruction. I will stand, and you'll be crushed. This is not the threat of somebody who wants to destroy them. This is an expression of the same one who has wept over them, and who's willing to be the son who is sent and given for them. When the Gospel of John gets to the hour, John chapter 12, Jesus says in 27, "Now is my soul troubled." He says in verse 31, "Now is the judgment of this world. Now is the ruler of this world cast out." If you and I could put ourselves in this picture this morning of the tension in the air as Jesus' hour draws near. And if we could take some of the things that Jesus has said to the crowd and apply them to ourselves, it might come out like this. I know you visited our town, but I never thought anything important happened there. I know you lived a perfect life, but that wasn't attractive to me. I know you offered your rule as the Prince of Peace, but I demand my way. I know you came to our synagogue to tell the good news, but I had other plans that day. I know you offered a warning, but I never thought it would happen to me. The scenes in Luke 19 and 20 are not just for people then. They're for us too. And as we think through the ministry of Jesus as we have then, we ought to come to this point and to think of how we stand with that king who rides over the hill on the colt of a donkey. You could confess him and be baptized in his name. Turn your life to him and live for him and enjoy peace with heaven. And that's the privilege we offer every time we routinely sing the invitation song. But that's what we want to do today. And if we can be of help to you in responding to the Lord, let us know while we stand and sing.